Chris Hurst, hello.
Hi.
I guess in the spirit of no bullshit, we're diving straight into this.
Okay.
Number one, design or strategy?
Design.
The pace here has got to be a little bit quicker, I feel.
Okay.
Okay, right. Second question.
Right.
Thinking or doing?
Doing.
Books or movies?
Books.
It's because you're selling one, but yeah.
No, it's always been books.
I'm fine, yeah. Data-driven or intuition-led?
Oh, data.
Wow. Most importantly, do I look like a rat or a fish?
Fish. I mostly said that because I think a fish is slightly less unflattering than a rat.
Yeah.
It's less kind of being polite. Yeah, I was probably just being polite.
I get that. Well, thanks. Yeah, I mean, you are the first to call me a fish.
There you go.
If that's, now it's made it more offensive because everybody else has called me a rat.
Yeah, exactly.
So they all hate me, but you.
I'm the one with empathy.
Wow. Well, yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm the one who's better at pretending to have empathy.
Yeah. Chris Hurst, right, we can finish that.
Yeah.
I'm gonna start with our traditional question. And that is, Chris Hurst, who on this world was the first person that made you feel like you had talent?
I'm gonna do a lot of swerving of your questions, and this is my first swerve.
Okay.
My because I've never really thought about myself as having talent.
Okay.
I never think about myself. I think I'm a talent at ... That's just not how I think about myself. I know that I'm good at some things, and I'm not saying that in a sense. I think that's a bad thing. I think that's an unhealthy attitude, by the way. I'm not saying that in a sort of a humble brag way. I don't think that's necessarily a good thing, but I think that's because I tend to look at myself and things generally and think, here's all the ways I could be better at that, or here's all the ways that could have been better, or here's all the ways we could have done that better. So I think that's a rather glass half empty way of viewing the world. So for that reason, I tend not to spend too much time reflecting on my level of talent. So I don't...
Objective.
Yeah.
It's very objective. Because my next question coming after this is probably going to be around how you began in engineering and ended up in Adland.
Yeah.
But I don't want to do that just yet, because I want to focus on that moment, because you said, I think something quite interesting about, you know, it's not being about me, it's about how I view something.
Yeah.
Why, when you were younger then, so like, when you're sort of, you know, trying to figure out what you were going to do with your career, you did go into something very... how do I describe engineering? It's a doing thing. It's very logical. It's mathsy. It's you know. I never went to university, so I struggle to describe it. But what happened to you? Somebody would have said to you before you went to Oxford University to study engineering, Chris, you got this thing. You should do something with it.
I don't think that people did say that. I think that people said you're quite good at maths. I'm an academic person. Okay. I had a conversation with somebody last night, actually, about education versus qualifications,
right,
which are not the same thing. They both have their role, but they're not the same. And so I was quite an academic person. I was good at most subjects at school. Or at least I was good at passing exams. Right. For most of those subjects. And honestly, at A level, I picked the A levels I thought would require least work for me, which is a sort of dumb decision you make when you're 16, right? And I know this is going to sound unlikely, but for me, that was applied maths, pure maths, and physics.
This is the weirdest interview I've done
on Craven. But I was just good at maths.
Right.
And the thing is, if you're good at maths, you don't have to remember dates and like when, I don't know, quotes and things like that. Right. You'd learn the patterns. And so I could do maths. And so, but, and here comes, and it's quite a big but, when you get to 18 and you think, okay, I'm going to go to university now. What degree am I going to do? If you do pure maths, applied maths and physics, you've got a pretty small choice of subjects. So then I end up doing engineering. You know, I didn't not want to do it, but I didn't sit and think, I really want to be an engineer.
Mm. What was going on at that point? Can I ask, what would I not see on your CV then? Because we're going to get to the moment where you went engineering into Adlan, which is the bit that I want to understand. But what do I not know about you then that you wouldn't see in your CV? Who was Chris Hurst at 18, 19? Very smart at maths, kind of lazy when it came to subjects.
That's a good question. I mean, I don't really know. I mean, I think I was very sheltered. And by that, what I mean is, you know, I grew up in a village in rural Northumberland in the 1980s. I mean, when people talk about the 90s, talk to people now about the 80s, right? And they think Porsches and red braces and all that kind of stuff. Let me tell you, I mean, the 80s passed Northumberland by. I mean, completely. I mean, totally passed it by.
Yeah.
Or certainly the bit I was in. So that wasn't my 80s at all. And so I lived in this really, I mean, I loved school. I had great friends. I found it quite easy. So I suppose that helps. I was good at sports. So I played every sport that was available. And, you know, I enjoyed it. I had a good time. But I didn't, you know, you don't know what you don't know. I didn't think I lived in a sheltered world. I thought I saw the whole world and knew everything like you do when you're 18. And so I think that then I then went and worked in a factory for a year because I did a degree in engineering, as you said. And my first job, I was sponsored through university by a company called Pilkington Glass. I could talk to you about glass for a long time if you like. It's a fascinating subject. So these were proper factories. I mean, these were factories with a huge furnace at one end that burnt at whatever thousands of degrees C, and flat glass came out the other end. You had to wear clogs on the factory floor because of the broken glass and the heat and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it was proper industry.
Yeah.
And going to St. Helens, which is where it was, in the Northwest, that was a culture shock for me. You know, going and working, being in a factory in the Northwest, working with the apprentices, that was a jolt for me. And also, it was a little bit, you know, there was a bit with them as well, like, okay, here's the kind of posh boy going to Oxford, you know, I suppose, as well. But at the same time, it was a by chance. I mean, I loved it. You know, I learned to weld, I learned about heavy current, you know, three-phase electricity, all that kind of stuff. Which was great, you know. I loved it. Went and day released a Runcorn Tech, and Runcorn Tech is next door to Spike Island. And anybody that knows the Stone Roses, that's where Stone Roses played, you know. And so we went to Spike Island because that was that's when I was there, you know. So it's kind of, it was a sort of a funny year, really. So that was kind of my, that was my introduction to the rest of the world.
So then Oxford University engineering, then Adlan. Who do you become at Oxford?
Questions about who I am or who I become, I don't think I'm very eloquent at. I think I roughly was the same person. I mean, you know, I listen to people talk about their experiences. Okay, not everybody. Some people's experiences at going to Oxford and Cambridge, and I don't recognize them because I thought it was great. I fitted right in. I met people the like of which I'd never met before in my life. I mean, people from the most expensive schools in the country, people from all around the world, people of incredible wealth, all this kind of stuff. And yet I found, by and large, the whole experience extremely welcoming and really enjoyed it. And I don't think I really, I mean, we all evolve. I mean, we all evolve as we grow up. So again, I think it was I'd gone from rural Northumberland to a very, I suppose a very working class, let's say industrial community. And it is certainly was then a very industrial community in St. Helens. St. Helens was built around its glass factories. And then from there to an incredibly privileged existence in Oxford. And I remember at the time realizing it was very privileged, you know, sitting there thinking, wow, I can't believe we're here.
Yeah.
But I don't have any conscious sense of changing other than I suppose I, you know, just started to see the world a little bit more, you know, people talking about things, like people talking about philosophy and stuff. And I was like, I have no idea. What on earth are they talking about?
Who's this Seneca chap?
How on earth are they talking about? I haven't even heard of the concepts. Yeah.
I was prodding because I think what I was kind of forcing an answer out of you there, which I thought was going to happen, which was I went to Oxford, I studied engineering, and then I thought, I don't want to do this. That advertising thing sounds quite interesting.
Well, that is what happened.
Okay. Because, you know, this again, knowing that we have two audiences, yeah. people that are joining.
Yeah.
Well, how on earth did you stumble across Adland and what happened there?
Well, so what happened was I did a degree. I did, you know, mass physics. I did a year in a factory. I then went and did a 4-year engineering degree. So it's by the time I finished that degree, it's 5 years since I finished school. So by then, I've kind of had enough of, you know, kind maths. Of education, maths. Yeah. And I also had a terrible, terrible shock at university because what I discovered was that actually I wasn't very good at maths at all. I was just the taller, you know, I was just the best person in my Northumberland comprehensive school. Actually, I was pretty crappy at maths. And I had to work incredibly hard. I mean, like harder than I've ever worked through that period to just keep my head above water. And so by the time I got to the end of it, the one thing I knew with absolute total clarity was I didn't want to be an engineer and I didn't want to work in engineering and I didn't want to work in a factory. I'd enjoyed that, but that's not what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. But for me, certainly up until that point, jobs were, you know, you went and worked in a factory of some description. Mm-hmm. I'm not making some sort of like working class hero. I'm not saying that, but you know, basically that's where jobs were. Jobs were in industry of some shape or form. Maybe I'd like to be in charge of the factory, but that's where it was. So I had an incredibly narrow perspective on what jobs I could go and do. And I remember, but I'm quite an organized person. So I was quite determined that I was going to organize myself. And I did spend a lot of time and effort trying to work out what I did want to do and trying to just get a job, frankly. So this was in 1994. So it was kind of sort of recession-y. Certainly there weren't a lot of graduate type jobs. And somebody from Sarching, so there were various milk round interviews. And I think one of the advantages being as Oxford is a lot of companies would come. And I went to a milk round presentation by Saatchi & Saatchi. And Saatchi & Saatchi at that point were, you know, everybody had heard of Saatchi & Saatchi, right? And then. And I thought, God, that sounds like as far away from a factory as I could possibly imagine. And so I applied, amongst other things, I applied to management consultancies and all sorts of places. But I thought, you know what, I'm going to try and get a job in advertising. So I applied to every agency I could find, I wrote to. And in the end, one of them offered me a job.
And this is where you began at BBH?
No, I had a year before then at a company called Still Price Lintas, which doesn't exist anymore.
Havas would have bought them. Right?
No, Lowe bought them. Lintas bought them after I'd gone. I did a year there and then went to BBH, yeah.
So you joined BBH, you could have been anything. Was strategist a thing at that point?
The strategist definitely was a thing at that point. And in fact, because I was the engineer, I joined the graduate scheme and I was, you're the maths guy, so you're the strategist.
Okay,
And of course, you know, the thing is, I have no idea, am I? Okay, happy days. You know, I have no idea what any of it is. I have no idea what any of these jobs are. Okay. There were three of us were hired as part of their kind of graduate program. I was the strategist, this other guy who had done an English degree, so he must be the account guy.
Yeah.
And then the other person didn't even turn up. I always remember that. I always think, what happened to that person who never came in? Never, ever came. Didn't write in or anything. Wow. Didn't write in or anything. They just never turned up. It's crazy, isn't it? So anyway, what happened over time, within 6 months, once we'd worked out what jobs were, he became the strategist, to become a very, very successful strategist, actually. And I became the suit. So yeah, once we'd worked out, because I wanted to be in charge. And that, I didn't want to sit on my own with a towel wrapped around my head. I'm sorry, strategists. I know they don't all do that, but, you know, sort of to be stereotypical about it.
I don't want to ruin the story, but there's a whole bunch of stuff that I want to get into. You then become quite quickly very senior at BBH in that role, and then move on to become managing director and then CEO of Grey, which is, I think, still to this day, for as long as I've been in this industry, which is more than half, less than half the time, I guess, than we have, the biggest agency turnaround that's ever happened. I want to know, I mean, for those that don't know, Grey literally were Grey by name, Grey by nature. Nobody really wanted to work there. It was, you know, terrible creative work was coming out of the agency.
Oh, it was a shit business.
PNG work that was just, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then the end of that story is that they become global or creative network of the in the world and all that kind of stuff. Amazing, amazing accolades. I remember actually being with you with gyrating dancers in cages in Cannes as you won some sort of Grand Prix. And we did a shot together. I remember saying congratulations. And you were you were at the top of your tree going, fuck, it was amazing. You probably don't remember that, but hello again.
Hello again. Yeah. Probably the shots that did that.
But take me through, what did you become, and you're going to hate this term if I say a superhero, that's kind of cheesy. What would have been your thing that everyone went, holy shit, Chris Hurst, he is world class at that thing, and that's why he's going to become the managing director of Grey? And then I want to get onto how was that brief sold to you?
Well, I think the story's a bit more, let's say, nuanced, you might say complicated than that, which is I went from BBH to Fallon.
Which is a good year for that was a good time for Fallon.
Well, it was when they were very, very small. So there's probably 10 of us. And I was, I think, like the first account guy or the second account guy they'd hired.
This is pre-Gorilla Drumming.
Oh, way before. Way before. I mean, I think we had two clients. I think we had Radio 1 and some other. It was very small. And there was the five partners, Michael Robert, Rich Andy and Lawrence, and about six of the rest of us. And, you know, I'd gone from BBH to Fallon, and it was Fallon McGilligott at the time, and that was their London office. They had this juggernaut office in Minneapolis. And BBH was kind of the best agency in the world then, I think. And I'm not sure any agency, in my opinion, has ever quite reached the heights that BBH reached at that point, in my opinion. Being at BBH, it was very tough. It was, you know, you had to be on your game. But going from there to Fallon, I felt like going from the back seat of a Bentley to the pillion rider on a motorbike. You're doing 80 miles an hour in both, you know, in both forms of transport, but your experience of that 80 miles an hour is completely different. It was that. So it's almost like I think those two experiences from this kind of real Rolls Royce business that was just such a finely honed machine at that point to a startup environment, you know, when it's a scrappy and rough and raw. Both really trying to do the same thing, both who were all about, you know, the absolute creme de la creme output. And so I kind of learned very contrasting things from both of those. And then I was then hired with four other people as a part of the sort of a turnaround leadership team at Grey. And that was in 2003, so that's 20 years ago, my God. By Gary Lace. And within 6 months, Gary had gone. Within a relatively short period of time, the team had started to fall apart. That all of those people, by the way, went on to absolutely stellar careers. But I kind of stayed, and I think I stayed through probably fear.
Fear of what?
Why did I stay? I don't know why I stayed. Well, fear of... I'd been overpromoted. I'd been made the managing director. I wasn't the CEO. And I think that I liked that title. I liked the money. But we weren't going anywhere. The business was, by 2009-ish, I was still the MD. I'd been passed over several times to be the CEO. The business was still a shit business. And if you get, if you've been there 6 years and the business is still a shit business, you're part of the problem, not part of the solution. And so I think that my options had narrowed down as a result of that. You know, I'd been hired as a kind of, you know, this sort of rock star, but by then I wasn't. No way. I mean, people would say, yeah, okay, Chris, he's fine. But I mean, look, he's gone a gray shit. He hasn't made any difference. And that would be a reasonable, I think that would be a reasonable thing to think, because I hadn't. So it was, that was a very, very difficult, quite a long and difficult time, really. I didn't have a, anyway. So, but then frankly, I kind of got lucky, I think. Perhaps, I mean, I was talking to somebody the other day, and they said somebody had done a survey and they'd asked very successful people. They'd asked very successful men and very successful women to kind of score themselves against, I don't know what the three attributes were that led to their success. And so let's say the attributes were, you know, sort of attitude, aptitude, and luck.
Right.
Okay. So give yourself a percentage for each. And so successful men score themselves 95% on aptitude and 5% on luck, and successful women score themselves in a far more balanced way across the three, I think, which is kind of interesting. But I'm firmly in the everybody needs a bit of luck and a bit of aptitude and a bit of attitude, right? Everybody does, and probably equal measures is about right. And so I got my 30% of luck then. My boss at the time got promoted. I think he didn't really want to be, but if he didn't take that job, somebody else was going to take it. So he did. And he took a bit of a punt on me, frankly, and made me the CEO. That's how I became CEO. I mean, I became CEO. Well, I think it was a bit of a punt.
Wow. What the hell happened then? Because, so you've been, this is the weirdest story. I never knew it went like this.
Yeah, so I know, because it is a weird story.
In my eye, I mean, when I was explaining to Ian, what I was like, this is Chris Hurst. So basically, he got great. It was a really shit brief. And then he turned it around and blah, 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 blah. I skipped this kind of, not a dull part of the story, shit bit. But the honest bit, right? It's the shit bit, which is like, he sort of didn't want to leave. And Chris could do it. So, okay, you get the title, a bump in cash. There must have been a moment of, I've got a change. I can do something here.
I think there was. I mean, I think by that point, because I think the lows that I'd gone through, quite a protracted, I mean, by the way, all this is post-rationalized. I mean, we all like to post-rationalize, right? But I think the lows in some ways made me feel less inhibited in some ways. I felt like, you know, I've been given this opportunity that I just didn't think was going to come. I'd convinced myself that I absolutely had to go. Well, I didn't know what I was going to do, even if that just meant walking away and go. I'd got to the point where I went, this is definitely not how I want my career to be. This has derailed big time. And suddenly this opportunity comes along. And I suppose what I first and foremost believed at that point was that the only good thing with having been there through this kind of shit 6 years with a succession of different CEOs and a succession of different people around me in the team, a succession of clients coming and going and just the same old, you know, not going anywhere, was I felt like I had a pretty clear view on how not to do it. You know, I thought to myself, look, the one thing that I'm absolutely certain about is we're not going to repeat the same mistakes that I've seen made thus far. We will make mistakes, but as far as we can, let's try and make mistakes all of our own, new mistakes. Let's not keep making those old ones again. And so, I know it is a cliche, but I think it is true that I think that failure and error, I mean, failure sounds quite final, but failure and error isn't just an occupational hazard for people in any job, but let's say leadership roles. It's not just an occupational hazard. it's a fundamental prerequisite for success. You absolutely cannot achieve anything in any walk of life worthwhile without lots of dollops of failure on the way. If you haven't failed along the way, you're not going to get there. Nothing goes in straight lines in the real world. So, you know, I suppose I was able to use that as a start. You know, you've got to, eventually you have to have more than just not making the same mistakes. But I think that enabled us to take quite a deliberately iconoclastic approach to how we were going to tackle the agency's problems.
Do you remember, because the one thing I get from your book, which I do want to come on to, No Bullshit Leadership is the old book, and
No Bullshit Change
is the new book, which you will come on to.
Okay, fine.
The thing I have picked up massively from that book is you are a man of action, and you are a man that goes, right, where are we going to, and how are we going to get there? I actually had this lovely, warm, cooling feeling on my head. I've just finished the Goldman Sachs course, and there was a lot of information.
Yeah.
And reading the first 20% of that book, I was like, oh my God. This guy is like stripped away a whole load of shit and fear and like confusion.
Yeah.
So the thing I get really clearly from just meeting you and reading you, strange way to put it, is this de-bullshitting and actually clarity and therefore moving into action. Do you remember then what the kind of, we're going to part this and we're going to go for that, and then the first actions?
I remember a meeting, and we said, roughly speaking, the meeting went, is there anything we're really good at? It's a good question to ask your business, right? Is there anything we're really good at? And the answer to that was no. There isn't anything we're really good at. There are some things we're quite good at. There's some things we're sort of average at. And there's a lot of things we're shit at. But there's nothing that we could, and certainly nothing that we could say we're the best at.
This feels very Ted Lasso, I'm
getting. Maybe. But all businesses should ask, all teams should ask themselves that question. And then the question is, okay, if we could choose anything, what is the thing, what is the first thing that we would choose to be, try and be the best at? What would that be? And there's a lot of there's a lot of things in agencies that could be the answer to that question. And what we decided in that conversation was, we decided the first thing we were going to try and be the best at is we were going to try and be the best at new business. And we were terrible at new business. And in reality, and by the way, I say we, everything that we achieved at Gray was a we, not an I. It was all, and I mean that absolutely sincerely, that the leadership team were a very talented group of people. But everything was about a we. And I also think that we were, and I think we had a degree of self-awareness about this. We also realized that actually we were very naive about new business. We didn't really understand it. Mm. We didn't really know how to do it. And that, and by the way, to cut to the present day, I mean, I had a lot of CEOs worked for me at in my role at Havas, and I think a lot of agencies don't understand new business. They really don't. They don't really understand what it's for, how it works, and how to do it. And so, and if they were to do one thing, that's what I would say to every agency CEO: go and learn how to be brilliant at new business.
How can you not be?
Because I think what happens is in businesses. All business, this applies in all businesses. The challenge is that there's a ton, it's drinking, like drinking from a fire hydrant. There's just a continual deluge of stuff. Stuff that's not working, stuff that needs to be better, stuff, you know, whatever it is, problems, strategies. I mean, you talked about the Goldman Sachs thing. You're just like absolutely deluged, all of which is really clever and all of which is right. But where do you begin? Okay. And I think that for my belief on agencies, particularly if you're taking an established business, I think possibly different in a startup environment, but possibly not. But let's take a situation like Gray then. I think that everybody says, well, yeah, of course new business is important. Of course it is. But well, of course, keeping our clients as happy is important. And of course, you know, worrying about profit is important. And staff morale is important. And, you know, redecorating reception is important. And, you know, and of course, winning awards is important. And effectiveness is important. So they're all important. But the fact is, you can't do them all. Imagine running a business like a graphic equalizer. Okay, so if you, you know, with all the different sliders on it, if you try and move them all, if you move them all forward by 1%, you're not going to notice the difference. If you take one of them, slide it from the bottom to the top, everybody notices the difference. You know, you can do that. And new business, it's not that people don't think it's important. My argument is, in many situations, it is the thing. It is the thing. If you say to yourself, we're going to become the best at new business, even if you become top 5, even if you become top 10, you know, you're on fire in a good way. and just about everything is so much easier than that. And so if you're going to do that, though, you have to, you know, I think it's a complicated 5-minute long way of saying prioritize, maybe, but the challenge with prioritization, everybody understands the concept of it, but what people find very difficult is the stopping. What it means is not picking one thing, it means not doing a load of other things. And that's hard because you've got people in your ear telling you need to repaint reception or, you know, whatever it is. And so, but we were very, very, very single-minded about that. We were extremely deliberate.
What was the second mouth to feed? So after that, okay, because I like the idea of prioritization being what are we not going to do rather than what we're doing. What was the, I guess, the second thing in contention with that where you were like, because this is ruthless priority.
Yeah.
And we're going, right, okay, everybody, you know, the game is this. We are 100% going to get better and world-class at new business. What was the next thing chopping away at you going, ah, we need to start shining onto that? Because you could win, you know, 5 back-to-back pitches and suddenly find yourself going from a £20 million turnover to 120 million. Then you're going to get some big scale problems, some growing pains and everything else. So what was the number two issue that you had to start turning your head to after that, do you think?
That continued to be our single and overriding focus. I think the number two for us, really, or number two isn't the next piece of the jigsaw is a better way of thinking about it, because number two is just is not as important. It is important, but we have to start somewhere. Was, I think, the quality of the creative work, and you know, we again, we had an absolutely superb creative director in Nils, and he had a fantastic team, and we had a fantastic strategy directors, and all those kind of things that you need and to build to create fantastic campaigns. And we developed a fantastic client portfolio as well. And, you know, to have a great reel as an agency, you need all those pieces in place and you need a bit of luck, right? So, you know, like, you know, always. And we had some luck and we had some bad luck, like everybody does. So we didn't really talk about, okay, that's one, now what's two? We knew that the work mattered. We knew that the, you know, painting reception mattered. We knew that, you know, having good client relationships mattered. The point was that we saw, you know, I fundamentally and I've always believed, and the thing I loved about my job at Grey and I loved about my job at Havas is I loved the running the business. I wanted to build a successful business. I wanted to build a great business. And great businesses grow. I don't think businesses exist in three phases. I don't think businesses are going up or they're going kind of sideways or they're going down. I think basically you're going up or you're going down. And if you're growing, then yeah, it brings some problems. People say, oh, that, you know, brings problems of its own. I mean, it's a hell of a fabulous problem to go from being a 10 million to a 20 million business. I mean, that's a, you know, we'll take that all day long. Because doing that, it's not just about being good at new business. It's about being a business that's growing. Mm. And if you're a business that's growing, your business is winning. You know, your business is confident. Suddenly you're attracting a different caliber of person. Suddenly you're attracting different types of clients. Suddenly you get cut a bit more slack by clients. Mm. Suddenly you get a bit more slack by awards juries. You know, all these things start to come. Suddenly you're a lot clearer. You know, being good at new business forces you to be clear about who you are.
At this point, because I remember great at this time.
Yeah.
I think we helped you guys hire a bunch of people. It seemed like the place that everybody wanted to do. It went from being the place that nobody wanted to be at to then everybody wanted to be at. And you heard the word fun. You know, you heard people saying, like, you know, it's work hard, play hard.
Yeah.
It's one of my questions, you know, if we're doing this, a linear podcast that comes at the end, but it feels right to do this now. When can you categorically say, I think most of the agency was having a lot of fun? Or I guess the better question is, because we have two answers, you know, business doing really well doesn't equalize happy staff.
No.
When do you think that the company was richest in its employee engagement and profits? And what was happening to make that happen, do you think?
That's a difficult question to answer. I mean, I think there was a period. I remember there was a period, and we'd probably been in roles for 18 months, something like that, maybe. I don't know, 2 years. And I remember saying to each other, which is kind of an arrogant thing to say, but I think it was true. I remember saying to each other, we're better than people think we are. Mm-hmm. You know, we're a better business than the industry thinks we are. And which wasn't saying much, because the industry thought we were completely shit. So it wasn't necessarily that high a bar. And that was fun, because I remember getting to a point where I remember thinking, when we're on a pitch list, people aren't going to want to lose to us because we're shitty grey, right? I mean, people be like, yeah, if we're on the pitch list and Wyden win, you know, it's no disgrace losing to Wyden, or it's no disgrace losing to whoever, I don't know, BBH or whatever. But, oh God, we don't want to lose to them, you know? And that was kind of fun. It was fun being the underdog.
Yeah.
You know, that was fun. And I remember us winning, you know, I think that the moment of transformation is we won the LucasAid pitch, and it was kind of the biggest pitch of the year, certainly the most high profile pitch of the year. You know, fabulous brand, done this incredible track record of amazing advertising. And it was a pitch with two rounds. They were gonna however many agencies in the first round, and then they were gonna chop a few out, and then they were gonna do a second round. And I remember the client ringing me after the first round and saying, you know, we're not going to the second round, you've won. And that was a, you know, that, you know, we thought, okay, right, we're getting some, you know, it's not all just talk.
Yeah. Okay, so getting to the end of Grey, we all know the ending of Grey, which is it went brilliantly well.
Yep.
And you did an amazing, amazing job. When did the love start to kind of die? And when did you think now might be my time to kind of...
I don't think the love died. I think I've just always been ambitious.
Right.
And I got offered a job at Havas. And that was to run Europe for them. And it's a European business. That was, I don't know if that was the biggest chunk of their business, but anyway, it was a big chunk of their business for the creative part of the creative network part of Havas. But the thing that I was really interested about that job was that in the UK, they had about 15 businesses in pretty well every part of the marketing services spectrum you could imagine. Creative, media, CRM, production. Corporate PR, production, consumer PR, internal communication, design, you name it, all of it. And these businesses were scattered all over London. I mean, literally scattered all over London. And most of them weren't called Havas. Most of them didn't particularly like each other. Some were very high performing. Some were shit. sounds a familiar story. The advertising agency were shit. And they had a plan to move all these businesses into one location. And that's when I joined. So there was a plan. They had a hole in the ground in King's Cross. That was it. There wasn't even a building on the site. And we had to work out how are we going to build a... What did we want to do? Mm. What did we want to... Okay, there's an opportunity. What should we do with it?
Wow.
How are we going to create something here out of this? And I loved that. I loved that challenge. And also this building that they didn't buy it, but you know, they signed a lease on. The rent was dramatically more than all the shitty other buildings they had everywhere else. So there was a diseconomy of scale. And I remember getting there in my first meeting, the CFO saying to me, "Oh yes, Chris, and if you could just tell us how we're going to make up those 5 points that we've lost off the bottom line by moving into a different building." And I'm like, "What? I don't know. I mean,
You picked the building.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Didn't you have a plan before I got here?" The answer was no. And of course, guess what the answer is? The answer is you've got to grow. And the business more than filled those 5 points by the time I left. But that was, you know, that was, and I wanted to experience different parts, different types of businesses. You know, I wanted to understand how those different businesses worked, what made them tick. I wanted the opportunity of how you can put those pieces together. I liked the blank piece of page-ness of it. And if it hadn't been for that, I don't think I'd have taken that job.
And stayed at Grey.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Okay, so right now, we fulfilled the duty of, or I guess the brief of Havas, which was, you know, come here, build a village, literally, of agencies and brands and businesses.
I said to them, I don't like the name Village, but it was too late. So that's a terrible name.
That wasn't
like,
my question.
Don't say that. I was like, okay, sure. Fine. Village is great. But doesn't village mean a bit crap? But anyway.
Depends. Depends where you are in England.
Yeah, so I was like, yeah, exactly. Depends where you are in England. So anyway, I shouted down on that.
So, okay, I'd love to dive into that, but I guess I want to move on to the book. And I guess also understanding what happened in your life, I guess, in your brain to go, I'm going to write a book and call it No Bullshit Leadership.
I like the idea of writing, short answer to that, I like the idea of writing a book. I was asked to do a talk on leadership and to some, I don't know, some people anyway. And I got the day before, like everybody, I thought about it the day before. But at the same time as I started thinking about it, I discovered that there were two other people doing the same at the same event, also talking about leadership. And I thought, oh shit. So I have to think of, it becomes competitive. Yeah. How am I going to say something that's just not what everybody else says? So I tried to think about something that not just everybody else says. I did it. I thought, well, you know, it's fine. That went quite well. And I thought to myself, well, I wonder if there's a book in that idea. And I didn't know. So I thought, well, I'll try and write some stuff. So I wrote 5,000 words or whatever. And then I thought, well, have I got anything else to say? And then I got to 10,000. And yeah, I probably got to about 10,000-15,000 words. And then I got a bit of luck. You know, I found someone who could help me, not help me write it, but help somebody. I found an agent who didn't sign me, but who was prepared to read what I'd written and was prepared to say, yeah, it's worth it. Yeah, that's kind of okay, keep going, you know. Yeah. So I did.
And if you were to summarize the book, I mean, it's quite does what it says on the tin. But I've read 45% of the book so far. The thing I get is clarity. But if you were to describe it to somebody else, why would somebody pick it up and what would they say back to you, do you think?
Well, it's a good question. Why would somebody pick it up? I think that the majority of people, so I'm not a famous author, okay? So people aren't searching my name when it comes to books on Amazon. Mm. So you don't really know why anybody picks your book up. It's like the old days with record sales. But, nobody knew who was buying your records. But I think, therefore, people pick it up because of the title. It's sold in, you know, business books get sold in this country, in airports, in railway stations, you know, that's where they typically get sold. And I think I had a big debate about the title. I wasn't sure about the title. I thought, you know, is it a bit crass? I don't want to write a crass book. I want to write a good book. I want to write a well-written book that's well thought through and that is an enjoyable, deliberately paced read. I don't want to write a flippant, you know, how not to give a fuck and all that sort of stuff. But I don't want to write that. So, but I think that in fact it's a relative, it's a bit Marmite, I think, as a title. I think some people probably do think, yeah, it's a bit flippant, it's not for me. And other people think that's exactly what I want. So I'd rather be a bit, you know, I'd rather polarize in that regard. And I think that's good. But I think what's been very gratifying about it, and it is, you know, it's an ego thing, of course, but, you know, people you've never met and you never probably never will meet send you emails or DMs or whatever on LinkedIn saying they really love it, you know, and not just love it, but it's really made a difference to them. And what's interesting about it is that's been FTSE 100 CEOs and that's 20-year-olds who haven't got a job yet.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that it's a book that, and I tried to write a book that wasn't pitched at a certain point in your career. Mm-hmm. It was pitched at a universal, not a universal understanding of leadership, a universal wiping away of the bullshit of leadership. That's a slightly convoluted saying.
No, I like that. That is kind of works in the onomatopoeia. No, it's not a word. Okay, so take away from that, if you were to sort of say, actually, I'm going to ask a different question. If there was one thing you could say to, I'm going to say somebody stepping up into a leadership position, because that is one of the biggest things that we see at the moment.
Yep.
Giving a bit of time to think about this. But one of the things that we, from our workshop, and everybody wants to work for you, is I'm a creative. I've always been a creative. And now suddenly I'm managing a team of six people. What the hell am I doing? Where do I start? What would you say to that person that has just become, from being a creative person, so now being a leader of creative people?
Well, I mean, I think the thing with leadership is, my whole point is when I hear people try and sort of say, well, you see, leadership is all about, and then adjective goes here. That is the ultimate bullshit. That's not what leadership's about. But I would say that if you had to press me, I'd say that if you remember two words, and those two words I think are clarity and action. And clarity means many things, but the first thing is you have to be clear in your own mind what it is you're trying to do. You can't lead if you don't know where you're trying to get to. And you can't lead if you don't know where you're starting from. So, you know, I think understanding you can't solve a problem if you're not clear about what that problem is. Mm. And you can't solve a problem if you're not then able to be clear with everybody else. Mm. So you have to be clear yourself what you're trying to do, and you have to be able to communicate clearly to your stakeholders. So that might be your team, that might be your boss. Virtually everybody has got a boss. Leadership is managing up and down. Mm. Your clients, whoever it is. And people, you know, I think there's a inverse correlation between the length of words and the length of sentences that people use and people's understanding. The more you understand something, the shorter the words you can use. The long words and long complicated sentences are just cover for not really knowing what the fuck you're talking about. And so use short words and use short sentences to explain what it is you're trying to do, because then you can understand and everybody can understand. So the first thing is be clear. You need to be clear. Everybody else needs to be clear. Mm-hmm. And then you need to navigate you need to decide what your milestones are going to be between your start and the end. I mean, you can't give people there isn't a unified theory to leadership. Mm-hmm. You know, every solution has to be different. But leadership ultimately is about action. And you'll know you're going wrong if every week you meet as a team, and people listening to this will do this. I've done this. You've done this. We've all done it. If you meet every week as a team and you find yourself discussing the same problem every week, every team does it.
Yeah.
Same. You come together every week and discuss the same problem. We're really good at, you know, we're really good at knowing what the problems are, but eventually you've got to go and act. Because if you don't act, you know, I think the biggest source of leadership failure is not people not understanding what the problem is, although I think that often people aren't prepared to be honest about what the problem is, which is different. The biggest source of failure is people's unwillingness or inability to act to get stuff done. Because when you act, we don't like acting, because when we act, that's when we can be seen to fail. And not just seen to fail, that's when we can fail. But failure is a prerequisite of success.
Wow. Because when I read that, that was the bit that really hit me. My mind at the moment is a lot of things, shiny things, da 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 da. But it's also a lot of repetitiveness of talking about the same things.
Yeah.
And I put that down to us not finding enough time. Yeah. But actually, it's not being really clear and it's not putting actions. I've just fallen in love, can I believe myself in saying this, with 21-day cycles that ladder up to OKRs. Who is this? I know. Right, but that, and the thing I found really interesting is variety. So you have a reoccurring diary invite, let's call it business development, right? And it's every Wednesday, it's for 2 hours, and the idea, the concept is a very innocent concept. We're going to show up every Wednesday and we're going to do BD.
Yeah.
The only change we're making to that every Wednesday is now it's across 21 days. And on the seventh day, we know that the BD, we're going to be out doing outreach to IPG businesses.
Yeah.
And on the following week, we're going to be... And the cool thing about 21-day cycles is on the 28th day, you review. We've never reviewed. We've never gone back and gone, what worked? What are we changing? What are we not?
Yeah.
So when I read that thing, I was like, this is what I mean by being the cooling towel to my brain in that book.
Yeah.
Is just hearing clarity in action. Although you simplified something very complex, it's perfectly simplified, I think. I want to ask you, because I know we've not got a ton of time, about the industry. And this is a very hard, quick thing that I've got to dive into, which is a very lengthy subject. From what I pick up, you've loved this industry and you've seen some incredible agencies at their peak. Do you think this industry is still the same in terms of producing the fun, enjoyable, work hard, play hard, you know, thing that you signed up to? And if not, where do you think it's heading?
Oh. I'm wary of generalizations, but I think it's, I do think it's an industry that's lost its confidence. And I think it's, and therefore I think it, because it's lost its confidence, I think some of that, you know, some of that joie de vivre has gone, I think. And we know why that is, you know, it depends, I suppose. It depends what part of the industry you're talking about. And the industry has both shrunk and expanded. Okay. So the type of businesses that I spent the formative parts of my career in, advertising agencies. I mean, they don't even call themselves advertising agencies anymore, because most of what they do isn't conventional advertising. that part of the industry has shrunk massively. What clients spend in advertising agencies is dramatically less than it was. And yet, by and large, there are pretty well as many of them as there ever were before. So there's this kind of, the pond is shrinking, but the same amount of fish are in it. And I think that's really tough. And that isn't going to change. That doesn't mean there's not room for great agencies. That doesn't mean there's not businesses that can grow, all those things that can happen. But I think it's just harder.
Where would you go if you were to back a horse now? It's the question we get asked the whole time, you know, people that are deciding to stay within this industry. The temptation is to go brand side, temptation is to go to a consultancy or service design. You know, there's a whole bunch of different things that are, you know, directions. Is there a direction that if you were sitting down with, I think the most transferable employee in an agency would probably be the strategist.
Yeah, probably.
So if you were sitting with a strategist who's maybe somewhere that's quite forward thinking, like an RGA, and they're saying, I have a few choices, because an RGA strategy director right now has a lot of choices. I could go to Mother. I could go to Stink. I could go to AKQA, or nearest competitor. Where would you go if you were that person or the CEO?
I would be wary of agency brands. The amount of times people tell me, oh, such and such is great because they worked at ...
Right.
Ay, come on. I mean, that's not proof. I would, which is not to say agency brands are meaningless, but I would not base a decision on a brand name. I personally would base a decision based on the what I felt the ambition of that business was. And by ambition, I mean, are they serious about whatever it is they want to be? Are they serious about doing the things they need to do to get there? Everybody says they're ambitious, but are they prepared to do the things they need to do to get there?
Yeah.
That's the big question. I think all of us should make career decisions based on what's in it for us. And I think that's not a an agency brand decision. That's not a, even a category decision. That's a specific role. You know, we all know you can go to the same, you can go to any business and you can work in team A and love it and work in team B and hate it. And that's all about leadership, right? That's culture. That is entirely about culture, that difference. So I can't give you a general answer to that question. I think you have to be, but I certainly wouldn't base it on brand.
Fine. That's a really fine answer. I want to just give him one shot because I know you would have thought about the Stinky Fish.
Stinky Fish, award dues.
Award dues? I've met there you at an award do.
I know. I've been to lots of awards dues.
What do you mean?
I think that award dues are getting in the way of the industry doing what it's supposed to do. So when I started in the industry, once upon a time, you'd talk to an agency, you'd look at an agency, and you'd look at the work that it gets paid for doing by its clients, and therefore the work that runs in the real world. And you'd look at the work that it enters for awards. And you could put the two circles like a Venn diagram, and those circles, there'd be a reasonable overlap. Wouldn't perfectly overlap, but there'd be a reasonable overlap. You know, there'd be, as an account director, I remember going and arguing with the creative directors about the fact they want to do a 90-second edit or a 2-minute edit, and the client would be screaming, going, yeah, but we're only running 30s. But nevertheless, you know, and of course that was for the award, but nevertheless, it was the same campaign, okay? Whereas now I think what you see is you see almost no overlap increasingly between the work that agencies are being paid by their clients to make and the work that clients are paying to put out there in the real world and the stuff that you see winning at award shows. It's those, I mean, people will write in and go, oh, no, we won for, of course there is some, but there is very little overlap between those. So, because you can go to major awards shows and you can see gold after gold after gold for campaigns that nobody in the real world ever sees. And I think that the industry has to fall back in love in using creativity to solve its clients' problems. That's what we're supposed to be there to do. And therefore, those two circles have to overlap. And I think the way the awards industry, and it is an industry, there's a lot of people making a lot of money out of it. The industry has to close the gap. At the moment, it's a game. Agencies know the rules of the game and they play those rules. But, you know, I don't think it's doing anybody any good.
Wow, you nailed that. I think that might be our best Stinky Fish, actually. I can see and feel this.
I thought I'd bring you a controversial one.
No, it was a good one.
Because also it's Cannes next week, right? Is it next week or week after?
It absolutely is, and we're not going. Yeah. We're doing UK, yeah. We're supporting Jeremy Green. You know.
Well, I'm not going. I got fired at Cannes. So.
It's a bad omen.
So, yeah.
Wow. Well, yeah. Chris says, thank you so much for joining me today. We will talk about the new book, and it's very important that we'll cover that in something on the out.
Honestly, we talked about books. It's fine. No problem.
Fine. Well, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this.
No problem. Thanks for having me.